Welcome, 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 ladies and gents, to the 39th episode of the Nasty Pasty podcast. How is everyone? How are you diddling? Well, the world goes to crap and daily drudgeries ever creep up on you. Just relax, because you're now tuned in to listen to me, you poor saps. You know me of old by now. Andy Roberts, just a video nasty enthusiast who loves to talk at length about how stupid moral panics over violent videos really are. To illustrate my cause, I'm on a crusade to view similar titles to the Video Nasty entries and compare them to the horrors that we Brits weren't allowed to see when Big Brother decided to stick his nose in. So far, I'm a little irritated that some of the titles I've covered weren't included on the Nasties list, as really they ought to have been, and it certainly would have marked them out for future generations to discover. As it stands, though, we're back on familiar territory today, where parents are decapitated, Western girls violated, native girls taken to the West, and ritualistic flesh-eating. Yes, we're back on the cannibal film for the last time on Nasty Pasty, so as usual, we've got two films of this genre to cover for you today. Obviously, we've covered the timeline of cannibal films quite a few times, so we won't retread that path too much today, but we'll maybe recap a little on each film's individual basis. We've got 1985's Amazonia, the Catherine Miles story, sometimes known as White Slave or Cannibal Holocaust 2, and we've also got 1980's Black Orgasm, which is sometimes known as Voodoo Baby and Sex and Black Magic. Two quite different interpretations of the cannibal theme, and they both involve a romance element to them, so rather atypical for a nasty Italian carnage film. Let's discuss our first film then this week. Amazonia. A young woman called Catherine speaks to a British journalist about an ordeal she suffered relating to natives. She flashes back to when she's on trial before the court in the Amazonas, indicted for the murder of two people. She tells her story of how she was schooled in England but returned to the Amazonas periodically as her parents lived there. On her 18th birthday, her parents throw her a surprise party, whilst her aunt and uncle wish her a welcome back, inviting her on a river ride on Catherine's father's boat. Her mother and father join, while her aunt and uncle bring a couple of their servants along for the ride. Catherine thanks her parents for her birthday gift, a jewelled crucifix, whilst her parents promise to return with Catherine to London. Shortly after, her parents are shot with blow darts from some natives in the foliage nearby, with Catherine herself being struck and getting knocked out. Some of the natives get on board, one of them, the leader called Umukai, drinking the blood from Catherine's wound, while another one uses a knife and decapitates her parents' corpses, stealing the heads. Catherine is then bound to a log and transported through the jungle, only stopping so that the natives can eat some caterpillars from a tree. During their break, one of the natives snatches her jewelled cross from her, and on the subsequent journey through the jungle, they encounter a hostile cannibal tribe with white-painted faces. They try to kidnap Catherine, but are killed by Umukai, who also decapitates them. A search party locates the remains of Catherine's boat and her parents' bodies and makes note of Catherine's absence. Umukai, Catherine and the other natives eventually reach the village where Catherine is stripped and smeared with a tribal mud and sold to one of the natives called Famateri in exchange for a goose, a pig and a turtle. Umukai seemingly wishes to own her, however, and offers his knife, the jeweled cross, and his own service in exchange for the ownership of Catherine. The offer is refused, however, and Famateri uses the opportunity to rape her, though he stops when he discovers that she's a virgin. Left to her own devices, Catherine makes an escape attempt, but is chased and brought back by her captors. As punishment for this transgression, she's violated by a piece of reed by several of the tribe's women, breaking her hymen and causing her immense trauma. Now no longer considered a virgin, Famateri tries to have sex with her again, only to fight back and be defended by Umukai. This time, Famateri accepts a fight to decide her owner, and the pair instigate a fight using clubs, which Umukai wins easily, killing Famateri. A girl called Lamari, Umukai's sister, explains that now Catherine is Umukai's woman, having been able to speak a little English due to being brought up in a mission. Famateri's funeral is held, and Catherine begins to have mixed feelings about Umukai, as he not only respects her but treats her quite well, though she cannot forget his involvement in the death of her parents. Lamari explains that Umukai is sad when he goes out one day to hunt, but Catherine cannot conceal her anger when she is constantly struck with the sight of her parents' heads in the main hut. During menstruation, in which the women are isolated alone, Catherine learns that betraying her man can lead to unspeakable consequences, though one night she cannot stand the thought of her parents' heads being around any longer and sneaks away with them in order to bury them. Caught in the act by Umukai, he instead removes the cross from his neck and buries it with the heads. A man entrusted to look after the heads is brutally beaten as punishment for the heads going missing, causing Catherine to feel extremely guilty. As penance, she offers to tend the man's wounds and fixes his dislocated knee. A woman called Adari is caught sleeping with another man, outside of her husband, and both she and he are punished with death, with him having his face smeared in honey to attract flesh-eating insects, while she is cast away on the river without a paddle, where she eventually drowns. The guardsman makes a full recovery from his injuries, leading the tribe to throw a celebration in Catherine's honour for her supposed powers, but she still refuses Umukai's kindness, despite his ever-increasing goodwill towards her. Catherine gets ever closer to the tribe, helping them fish, build, and enjoying the sights of the jungle. Lamari announces that she's soon going to be having a baby, endearing Catherine further, and when Lamari reveals that she's been teaching Umukai how to speak English, she also reveals that Umukai did not kill Catherine's parents, but he did see who did. Just after this, a helicopter flies by and begins indiscriminately gunning the natives down, killing Lamari and a few of the others. Upset, Catherine lashes out at Umukai over her parents' deaths, but he refutes the claim, revealing that it was in fact the servants of Catherine's aunt and uncle who performed the deed. Once they'd finished, her aunt and uncle slaughtered them and left their bodies. She believes him and begins to see him in a new light, though she does become upset when he's bitten by a snake, rendering him unconscious. She aids his injury and begins to act tenderly towards him. In return, Umukai throws his knife away for good and devotes himself completely to her. The pair make love, and after expressing a desire for revenge, Umukai agrees to sail her upriver to her parents' plantation. Armed with several weapons, she bursts into her previous home, finding her aunt and uncle in her parents' bedroom. Hearing their excuses, Catherine fires a poisoned arrow into her uncle's hand, killing him, while she scratches a paralyzing poison into her aunt's arm before decapitating the pair with a hatchet. Returning to Umukai, Catherine realizes he can no longer touch her due to his tribe's taboo of women committing murder, and she feels no longer worthy of his affections, jumping into the waters and heading back to civilization. She hands herself into the police, which leads to her being indicted for the murders. After recounting her story, footage is then shown in court of the discovery of her bodies, leading to her being granted a not guilty plea by temporary insanity. After being admitted for 8 years to a psychiatric hospital, Catherine is then released and sent back home to England, where she marries and has a child of her own. After speaking with the journalist from the opening, Catherine helps her little boy retrieve his boat, which has capsized on the river. Picking it up, she flashbacks to when she left Umukai for the last time, where it's revealed that he could not live without her. He overturned his boat and he chose to drown. Remembering his sacrifice and kindness, she cannot hold back her tears.
But didn't you lead Umukai on in order to get him to help you?
I did no such thing. He acted on his own. And since he had nothing else to exchange, he offered his weapons, my cross and himself as a slave in order to own me. But Famateri refused his offer, so Umakai challenged him to a fight. Famateri didn't accept that either. I began to have a vague sense of foreboding of the long and terrible ordeal that was in store for me. Famateri stopped when he realized I was a virgin. He and the women were amazed and amused because the Guainira artificially deflower all girls at the age of 4.
I asked the defendant to stick to the facts. These particulars are irrelevant.
No, Your Honor. They will help establish the defense of my client.
Proceed, Senorita Miles.
I was so humiliated, I wanted to die, but then I could hear my father's last words.
Never give up on life, whatever the price. Live, Kathy. It's the only thing that counts. Nothing else means a damn thing.
Then you were not raped by this man, Famateri?
No. In fact, the Indians treated me as a child and left me alone sometimes. So one morning I managed to run away. My one thought was to escape, but to where? There was nothing but dense jungle all around me, but I kept running like a frightened animal, trying to find a way out of that green hell I was condemned to.
As you know, the cannibal cycle had been around since 1972 when Umberto Lenzi released his film The Man from Deep River, which did make it on the Nasties list as Deep River Savages. Throughout the 70s and the early 80s, other cannibal films surfaced which cashed in on the whole jungle savagery craze. Stuff like Emmanuel and the Last Cannibals, Last Cannibal World, Mountain of the Cannibal Gods, Savage Terror, Eaten Alive, etc., etc. The granddaddy of them all, though, was arguably Cannibal Holocaust, absolutely infamous even today. This boosted interest, though, in the genre even further, with Zombie Holocaust, as Devil Hunter, Cannibals, Cannibal Terror, and Cannibal Ferox following in the wake of Diodato's Shocker. By the time of Jess Franco's Diamonds of Kilimanjaro, the cannibal film had suffered a steep decline, disappearing entirely from the cinematic landscape. Scholars often refer to this period, 1972 to 1982, as the first cycle of cannibal films, as there were no further entries until 1985. Seemingly engendered by reruns of Cannibal Ferox in 1983 in the US, four new cannibal films were released after 1985, most of which we've covered as well. These were Amazonia, Cut and Run, Massacre in Dinosaur Valley, and Against Nature, also known as The Green Inferno. These latter films are often known as the second cycle of films, purposely made to try and stir up more interest in the genre, but they arguably failed as the genre disappeared entirely in 1988, and it hasn't really surfaced since with the exception of purposefully referential works by both Bruno Mattei and Eli Roth. Amazonia was therefore made to revive interest in the cannibal film, and it certainly ticks most of the right boxes. You have your jungle setting, this time set in Venezuela instead of the actual Amazon. You have your Western characters encroaching into hostile territory only to be killed or kidnapped. You have primitive rituals and customs, some graphic gore, some sexual violence, some animal violence. Notably, though, the film doesn't quite bombard you with the type of unremitting wave of violence and cruelty that Lenzi or Deodato would have done. Instead, there are changes to the genre's staples that make the film more accessible for the casual viewer. For example, there's no actual on-screen cannibalism in the film. Well, unless you count Umakai's blood drinking from Catherine's arm, and I'm not in this instance. Cannibals are mentioned as a rival tribe, but notably Umakai's tribe find that practice taboo, which is quite a notable change in direction. The gore instead is relegated to decapitations, some stabbings, arrow shots, etc., etc. It is actually quite a gory flick, surprisingly, but the difference is that the camera doesn't linger on the strong violence as much as you'd expect. There's some sexual violence, but it's always portrayed in quite a non-erotic, non-exploitative way. It certainly can't be deemed as graphic. There is the requisite animal violence too, though thankfully most of it is a more Discovery Channel nature, which it doesn't appear to have been deliberately staged in order to film, which is why I believe that it's intact in the current version, which was released literally days ago. For example, a leopard eats a deer and another leopard catches a monkey and stuff of that nature. A snake does lose its head though, courtesy of Umakai's character, so it's not all animal infighting, I'm afraid, but I do have a suspicion that this scene is actually faked. Other elements that you'd expect in a cannibal flick are the true story angle that the film tries to get you to buy into, even giving you some found footage of the real Catherine Miles in a mental institution. It also wouldn't be an Italian movie if it didn't have a slap in it, so true to form, Catherine gets mashed in the face by Umekai when she goes hysterical over something. One of the other elements that is particularly prominent in this example is the influence of Mondo films. The intro credits are very similar to a Mondo film, and I genuinely could have believed I was watching such a film. The film also has some random sequences of footage involving animals with varying qualities of film stock, again giving the impression that it's a mishmash Mondo title. This carries on throughout it, even with Mondo-esque explanations from Catherine's perspective, as though she's the Mondo narrator. Having said that, it is not to the level of Against Nature, which we covered before, which is virtually a Mondo film just in a cannibal skin. So outside of the toned-down nasty elements, we actually have quite a decent story that is sort of a reworking of Umberto Lenzi's Man from Deep River, only with a female protagonist instead of a male one. Instead of falling afoul of cannibals or being punished for bad behaviour, our sole protagonist Catherine is kidnapped and taken in by a native tribe and put through various trials and tribulations, very similar to the character of Bradley in Lenzi's film. It's rather notable how the film, though, is really focused on a feminine perspective, as most of these films are from a male viewpoint. Other films do handle their women differently. I mean, for example, in Sergio Martino's Mountain of the Cannibal God, for instance, the perspective is much looser. It kind of rotates from Susan to Foster, and then to Manolo for the over the course of the film, while Cannibal Ferox starts with our female protagonist Gloria, and then seems to focus mainly on the antagonist Mike for most of the film, only to then return to Gloria again towards the end. Amazonia is purely focused on Catherine, and it's a breath of fresh air to hear a female-based story in the jungle. Obviously, because the dynamic has changed because of the different gender, Catherine does get a slightly worse side of the deal when taken in by the tribe, in that she's traded essentially as a piece of property, traded for animals, no less. She's subject to a ritualistic deflowering, although she later recounts that this was not a malicious act by the tribe, and merely a way for them to acknowledge her as a grown woman. I mean, it's still iffy regardless, especially as the tribe savour purity and loyalty to one's husband with the punishment of death for any adulterers. While the tribe's less than ethical society is focused on in several sections, the main thread of the story is that of Catherine's desire for revenge, most of which is channeled towards Umekai, whom she blames for her parents' death. This desire for vengeance is really strong, lengthened by the constant sight of her parents' severed heads in the tribe's hut. Umekai, however, remains stalwartly kind to her, in spite of her angry responses to his affections. She's constantly in battle with her emotions as she tries to bury the respect and fondness she has for him with the intense hatred that she holds for his brutal acts. It's only when he reveals the truth of what happened does she finally embrace him for all of his kind deeds, and she does genuinely fall in love with him. He's quite a noble chap, really, as he puts up with so much rejection from her and still treats her quite respectfully. While this is a major part of the plot, Catherine's revenge takes centre stage, and she kills her aunt and uncle in retribution for their betrayal of her parents, especially as it was all to gain a rotten plantation. Having said that, I was hoping for Catherine to go a bit more psychotic than she did. I mean, I literally wanted them jigged into pieces with a volley of axe blows, but maybe that's just because I'm a gore hound. It's still satisfying regardless. And there's also a hint of conflict between what is morally right and the doctrine of religious stoicism. Kathy's mother buys her a jewelled cross as a birthday present. She talks about believing in God halfway through the film. Kathy, however, does begin to turn away from these beliefs, as she does believe God has placed her in this position and now refuses to help her out. While she doesn't really denounce her beliefs completely, she does take more of her father's viewpoint on the situation, where he preaches to fight for your life regardless of the price. Her double murder of her betrayers is proof that she takes this path, and morally is the right thing to do for their heinous crimes. It did come at a price, though, as her father warned. Umekai can now no longer touch her, as it's quite taboo for women to commit murder in that tribe. Kathy does seem to realise this, though, and swims away, not wanting to further dirty Umekai's customs and way of life. Rather heartbreakingly, though, Umekai cannot see a way of living without her, as he also loves her himself, and he chooses to end his life rather than continue without Kathy. It's quite a bit bleak, but it's really meaningful for what on the outside seemed like just another nasty Italian cannibal film. The whole plot has echoes of Kathy and Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights, too, with Umekai playing the role of the Byronic hero, hated by Kathy for his seemingly murderous acts, and her acting rather spitefully towards him. Even her vengeance sequence has her aunt and uncle decry her as not real because she's dead, with her retort being, sometimes the dead come back. It has tinges of that scene where Kathy's ghost returns to Wuthering Heights, her home, looking for her love Heathcliff. And also, rather poignantly, Umukai chooses to kill himself shortly after this sequence, almost identically to Heathcliff, who dies shortly after Kathy's ghost encounter. Of course, I'm not saying that Amazonia has the same sentiment and the effect as Emily Bronte's work, but it definitely has those right ingredients from a true and tested formula. The way that the film is shot is also rather stunning. I mean, the lush green nature of Venezuela is beautifully photographed, and it really adds to that Mondo-esque feel to the cinematography. There's a rather beautiful shot as well when Catherine is playing the flute, where the camera zooms out from looking at the sun, with several rings of light forming and then disappearing. Combined with the tune, it's quite a memorable and a mesmerising shot. Of course, the true story aspect is ultimately laughable. The purported real footage of the real Catherine Miles in an institution is just giggle-inducing as to how ham-fisted it is. But at the same time, Mondo Films did this sort of trick all the time with clearly staged footage, so it's clear that the filmmakers were operating within those conventions more than I expected. The film's structure of being told in flashback within a flashback is really kind of unique, especially when one of the narrative devices is that of a court trial. The court statements and Catherine's inner monologues are constantly played over the film during the scenes of the tribe, really lending to that Mondo feeling of being guided through it all by a narrator. All in all, it's way more accessible to the casual horror fan and quite lighter in tone compared to the heavy commentary of Cannibal Holocaust or the intense violence of Cannibal Ferox, so it's a good alternative if you want all the entertaining elements without any of the nastiness. The alternative title of Cannibal Holocaust 2 is therefore very purposely misleading, just like Cannibal Ferox 2, or i.e. Massacre in Dinosaur Valley. Amazonia is just nowhere near the level of Diodato's film, although the main music theme of Amazonia, it does have very slight similarities to Ritz Ortolani's somber ballad from Cannibal Holocaust. Main actress Elvira Audrey, who played the titular Catherine Miles, was presumably a French actress who'd been in a handful of Italian films herself, like Sergio Martino's The Scorpion with Two Tails and Lenzi's Iron Master. She tragically ended her life, though, through a drug overdose, seemingly, at the age of 40 in the year 2000, which is an incredible shame. Andrea Coppola played Kathy's uncle. He'd been in quite a few sporadic films, too, like Escape from the Bronx and Hands of Steel. We've also encountered Rick Battaglia before, who played Kathy's father in this, when we did Deported Women of the SS special section a few episodes back. But he was also in Fulci's White Fang and Sister Emmanuel, that sort of thing. But surprisingly, for a decent jungle romp, and one that's not too obscure, hardly any of the other cast members did anything else outside of this one film. So, go figure. Director Mario Gariazzo had also a rather small filmography, but he notably produced and wrote the scripts for various things, like Sister Emmanuel and Drummer of Vengeance. The film was written by Francesco Prosperi, whom we've encountered before on Mondo Carne. Now, Prosperi, of course, was the frequent partner of Antonio Clamati, the director of Against Nature, or The Green Inferno, both of them rather infamous for their work in the Mondo genre. Arguably, this is the reason why Amazonia has such a Mondo-like flavour. The cinematography on this occasion was done by Silvano Ippoliti, a veteran of his field who'd been working since the 60s. Some of his other projects were Iguana with the Tongue of Fire, Salon Kitty, which we've covered before, and Tintobrass's other infamous film, Caligula. Editor Gianfranco Amicucci had worked on Enzo Castellari's Bronx Warriors trilogy of films, as well as House by the Edge of the Lake and The Last Shark, which starred James Franciscus. The special makeup effects were done by someone familiar, Franco Di Girolamo, who we only covered last week on Don't Torture a Duckling. He was assisted by Rosario Prestipino, who also had quite a broad spectrum of work, on stuff like Zombie Flesh Eaters, Zombie Holocaust, City of the Living Dead, Burial Ground, The Black Cat, The New York Ripper, which we've covered, and both Demons films. Finally, there was Aldo Gaspari, who had a relatively short filmography, but arguably had a hand in one of the most notorious films in terms of special effects, Cannibal Holocaust. Assistant director Giuseppe Giglietti had also worked on a similar capacity on The Last Shark, the Bronx Warriors films, and Ghoulies 2. Finally, script supervisor Rosario Salento had worked in various capacities across a range of Italian films, like The Continuity on Seven Bloodstained Orchids and Alien Terror, or she worked on script supervising again on stuff like Terror Express and The Wax Mask. The film received theatrical release in Italy in 1985 under the title Schiavi Bianchi, and it received a limited theatrical run later that year in the US. Subsequent releases appeared in France and Germany, but we in the UK got the film direct to video in late 85 from Avatar Video. Of course, by 1985, the Video Recordings Act had come into effect, so the film had to be legitimately classified, like all the others at the time, so there wasn't a chance that it was seized, as that had all been done already. It did, however, incur the wrath of the censorious aftermath of the Nasty's fallout, losing 52 seconds of material in order to obtain an 18 rating. The BBFC, though, haven't disclosed any details of the cuts, but I'd assume they were for the either the animal violence sequences or the more intense gore sequences of the beheadings. It did get another release in early 2003, which seems to have had some of the cuts waived, but not all of them. It then seems to be available in various formats throughout Europe and America, but we in the UK are in luck, however, as a brand spanking new remastered uncut version has surfaced literally only a few days ago from 88 Films on Blu-ray, and it comes with all sorts of yummy extras too, like a documentary on the latter cannibal film cycle. Well worth picking up, especially as the colours and the cinematography now look huge tons better from what we previously had, so this guy here really recommends it. So, that was Amazonia. I really, really enjoyed this one. Despite them being less intense, I really do like the late cannibal films. They still do have that vibe of the really nasty ones, but they're just a bit more palatable and fun to enjoy. Let's get straight on to our next film of the day, which is Joe D'Amato's Black Orgasm. A tribal ceremony on a beach is given to an old man, seemingly killed by a shark, in order to save his soul from vanishing. The man's wife and daughter participate in the ritual too, engaging in cannibalism of his body to conclude it, whilst a Westerner looks on from the sidelines. Meanwhile, a woman called Helen arrives by plane and is picked up by her friend and lift Henry, who takes her back to his house to freshen up, letting her know that he is still in love with her, despite her marriage to a man called Paul. He takes her by plane to a small island where he's due to meet her husband, who is the Westerner who's watching the ceremony from the opening. They discuss Helen's fertility, which is in question as she's failed to conceive so far, but she reveals that she is waiting medical advice from her doctor. They have sex later that night, to a rather muted response from Helen, who pleasures herself after Paul is gone. The next day, Helen encounters the daughter of the dead man, called Hyene, and the pair play around in the sea before Hyene carves a flute from wood and plays a tune, attracting the attention of Paul. After Hyene performs a ritualistic dance and invites Helen to another of her father's ceremonies, Helen asks that Hyene return with her to the city if she's allowed to. She undergoes a leaving ceremony, which involves being whipped by her mother, and she's then able to leave, with Helen taking her out to see tourist spots on the mainland. In the evening, she throws a party at her house, where Hyene is treated to lavish attention from all of the male guests, though she rejects the advances of her chaperone the next day whilst out in a boat. At another visit the next day, Lydia, the girlfriend of Henry, becomes besotted by Hyene and touches her sexually outside, which Helen notices to her disappointment. Hyene notices her upset and tries to reassure her that all women from her tribe have sexual encounters with women before they have any experience with men. Out of spite to both Hyene and Lydia, Helen visits Henry and initiates sex with him, explaining that she needs sex daily. Hyene seemingly shuns her when she visits her at night, and after pleasuring herself, Hyene burns a tribal mix of herbs, only to suddenly see a man in the mirror behind her. The man is seemingly a random pickup by Helen in a bar, but Hyene now perceives this as a threat and attacks the man with a machete in the middle of their sex session. Helen, seeing that Hyene seems to now care, passionately embraces her before going out onto the beach and making love on the sands. Paul makes a surprise return to the house, explaining that his studies have ended early. The pair continue their affair, whilst Helen avoids intimacy with her own husband. He discovers their tryst whilst glancing outside the next day, and he confronts Helen, decrying her for perverting a motherly role into a lover's role and suggesting that Hyene be returned so that their marriage can be saved. Helen snaps back, however, claiming that if Hyene leaves, so will she, as she has fallen in love with her for her gentle nature and the fact that she does not demand that she have a child. A drunken Paul then tries to solicit sex from women in the local bar, whilst Helen tends to an upset Hyene, who is worried that she'll be taken back home where she is now no longer welcome. Paul goes to see Henry for advice, who, because of his own attraction to Helen, reveals all of her infidelities to make him leave her. Now fueled by anger, Paul walks in on Hyene and Helen and knocks her out of the way, and he then rapes Hyene while Helen watches, until Hyene starts to enjoy it, at which point Helen joins in on it to make it a menage a trois. Now, having experienced a man, Hyene has a sexual fantasy wherein she orally pleasures a man. Helen then receives a letter from her gynecologist confirming that a pregnancy is now possible, making Paul so happy that he takes Helen out for lunch. Helen now believes that Paul does indeed still have feelings for her, and confirms that possibly it is best that Hyene should leave. Returning home, the married couple make love while Hyene performs another ritual in her own bedroom involving a doll. The next day, Paul, Helen and Hyene make their way back to the tribe by boat, with Hyene clearly upset at the prospect of being left behind. Helen bids her farewell one last time before Paul leads her into the jungle. Reaching the beach and locating her tribe, both Paul and Hyene are encircled just as Helen becomes impatient and wanders off to search for them. Paul is given a drink which he sips, only to fall into a slumber. The tribe lay him down on a pyre, similar to the opening ceremony, just before Hyene stabs him in the chest. As Helen arrives, Hyene wanders over with blood-stained lips, and she offers a piece of meat to Helen, claiming that now they can be together forever, with Paul a part of their bodies and souls. Asking to see him, Helen is horrified to see her husband's corpse upon the pyre. Just before we start, I understand that I didn't include a clip from the movie as I usually do. And this is not because I've forgotten, it's simply because I just cannot find an English dub of this movie anywhere. Usually when I watch a film in something other than English, I still try to find an English dub for the show so that people can hear a short clip of the film that you're about to hear about. But in this case, I gave up because it took me a lot of time, effort, Google Translate and sheer willpower to find the version that I did, and it turned out to be in Italian. So, sorry about that, folks. Stelvio Cipriani's soundtrack will just have to do. But okay, I think I can safely say, having seen quite a bit of Joe D'Amato's filmography already, that despite him being credited with making three cannibal films in his repertoire, he only really made one true cannibal movie, and that's the one we've already covered, Emmanuel and the Last Cannibals. While it did have a lot of the sexploitation aspect to it, the narrative and the story to it was the exact template of a cannibal film, and it did have the requisite gore and violence in it too. You may also remember that we covered Papaya, Love Goddess of the Cannibals, which, while having some of the elements of cannibal films, was largely a sexploitation picture, focused on carnal encounters with a tropical Caribbean backdrop. Papaya was filmed in 1978, shot when D'Amato had travelled to Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic. He also filmed his action picture Tough to Kill whilst here too, but then returned to Italy towards the latter end of the year. After releasing one of his more famous works, Beyond the Darkness, or Buio Omega, D'Amato longed to return to the tropical location of Santo Domingo, and he returned for a second time in the later half of 1979. Black Orgasm is one of those filmed by D'Amato on his second excursion to the Caribbean, and it has bedfellows with a number of D'Amato's more experimental films of this era. Presumably to meet an ever-ravenous European market eager for exploitation, D'Amato started playing with the idea of hardcore pornography and other themes together, usually from the horror genre. This includes Porno Holocaust, a slasher splatter film, Erotic Nights of the Living Dead, a zombie film, Hard Sensation, a rape and revenge film, and another sexploitation flick called Black Sex. Black Orgasm, therefore, is extremely similar to Papaya, Love Goddess of the Cannibals, in that it's mostly a sexploitation drama, with only minor elements that are cherry-picked from the cannibal genre. For example, the film opens with a ceremony in which Hyene and her mother devour a piece of flesh from Hyene's father's corpse, and the film ends with a similar ceremony, but this time ending with Paul's death and partial consumption. But these are the only instances of cannibalism in the film, and they're not particularly explicit either. We have our Western characters who invade the land of the natives in search of personal gain. In Paul's case, it's research data, whereas for Helen, it's for a person to be intimate with. That person is Hyene, who's plucked from her tribe and taken to live on the mainland in the modern Western world. This imperialistic element features in several cannibal films, where Western characters take what they want from the natives and suffer consequences as a result. Helen certainly suffers consequences, though it's more planned and subtle than the outright savagery that the characters in this film would normally endure. Apart from some exotic jungle locations and the non-consensual forcing of Hyene to have sex with Paul, the film does lack any other features that would otherwise make it a cannibal film. This did disappoint me slightly, and no doubt it would irritate others who tune in expecting the usual flesh-eating carnage. Without the gore and the jungle savages, what we have here is a melodrama with as much nudity and sex crammed in as you can expect from Joe D'Amato. Helen is our main protagonist, an unhappy woman by all accounts, who's under pressure from her distant husband Paul about giving him the son that he desperately desires. Paul seems more into his research than paying his wife as much attention, seemingly performing in the bedroom rather woodenly without passion. Helen understandably does need comfort and affection from somewhere, and she seeks it in Hyene, a native girl from the local tribe. The tribe itself seems very similar to the one in Papaya. I mean, they dress in modern clothes, they live in modern homes, but they just practice bizarre rituals and rites as part of their inherited traditions. For example, Hyene is whipped by her mother for choosing to leave the tribe for the mainland, and is then banished, unable to return. She is rather a mystery, though, despite being so young and seemingly naive. I mean, she attracts the attention of everyone around her for her gentle beauty and svelte figure, including both men and women. She also appears to have feelings for Helen, evidenced by her becoming violent towards any perceived threats. At the same time, though, her retributive rituals that she enacts, and the inaction she displays despite knowing that Paul is taking her back to her family when she's so upset at the prospect before, suggests that there is a deeper, more insidious objective that she has on the Westerners. Indeed, despite being banished from her tribe, they welcome her back almost instantly at the prospect of being able to feed on a dead man, so there's definitely something to her that we're not quite getting. Despite being our main character, Helen is not particularly likeable for several reasons. Firstly, she's very disloyal. She cheats on her husband with several men, and Hyene, and she's hinted to have also solicited sex from other black men in the area. I mean, I know her marriage might be going stale, but promiscuity is neither the answer, nor is it that attractive to someone's character. She also doesn't really defend Hyene when Paul rapes her. Granted, she does get knocked to the floor beforehand, but if the person you love was being attacked, your innate sense of protection would kick in and you'd kick, bite, scream, and do all that you can to help them. Helen simply sits and watches, only to then join in when Hyene has stopped struggling. Now, I understand that controversially this is probably just to please the male voyeurs who watch this sort of film, but it's nonetheless a blot on her as a person. Finally, once she has the good news that she's fertile after all, Helen all but abandons Hyene and enthusiastically agrees to send her back, despite being the one to have removed her from the tribe in the first place. It's really that irritating and thoughtless action of ruining someone else's life in order to better your own, and then just discarding them when you no longer need them. So, yeah, not a very nice lady. Neither is Paul, though. He doesn't really give his wife the affection she needs, and the only time that he's impassioned enough to show her that he means business, he uses that energy instead to force himself on Hyene, so he's no bloody better. The only real innocent party here is Hyene, but this doe-eyed naivety is smashed when the ending reveals that she's planned this sacrifice of Paul the whole time. Not only that, it does suggest that natives cannot be trusted and that we're right to be suspicious of their black magic and strange customs, which is rather a racist sentiment, especially considering the film up until this point had been rather positive about the individuality and the trustworthiness of such tribes. I also wonder whether the idea is that Hyene is so attractive and mystical to all those around her is because she's used magic to purposely have people flock around her and screw each other over for her in order so that she can possess them for herself. This would in effect mean that she's pretty much the same character as Papaya from D'Amato's other film, like a sex siren who just lures people nearby in order to kill them. Perfectly justifiable though with the behaviour of our supposed good guys. The issue with the film, of course, is that it's been written purely to cash in on the nubile bodies of its female cast members, rather than to deal with a credible or noteworthy story. The racist undertones as well are also in line with what to expect from an Italian cannibal flick, so maybe it's got more in common with the typical gut muncher than I thought. The story, interestingly, is pretty much a reworking of the 1972 film The Girl with the Skin of the Moon, or La Ragazza dalla Pelle di Luna, which also focuses on a married couple with issues who go to a tropical island and end up doing shenanigans with other people. Clearly this whole Westerners frolicking in bed with exotic people was in fashion many years ago. Of course today we just have interracial pornography to satisfy this need. Indeed, the overwhelming feature of this film is the sex sequences, so for those who like that sort of thing, there is plenty of TNA on show, so to speak. The female characters frequently touch themselves on their own, they fondle each other, have full-blown sex on the beach, or have men involved in various degrees. It's mostly softcore, but funnily, there are a few sequences of hardcore that made it into the final version. For example, there's a scene in a bar where there's a brief shot of a cock being played with under a table or something. And later, after her ordeal with Paul, Hyene masturbates and has a fantasy where she gives fellatio in full view to a guy with a porn stash. I have no doubt that there's probably a harder cut of Black Orgasm out there somewhere, but quite frankly, it would do little to perk up the proceedings significantly. This is also one of those films where my partner often walks in and says, "Oh, you're watching one of these films again." It must seem quite odd to others that as a homosexual, I often watch sexploitation films from this era where women are pretty much the sole focus. Reason why, a lot of the original video nasties were of this ilk, so I ended up watching quite a few, and then I've just gone on to watch similar films from the same era. I've grown so used to watching them that I often just find them humorous, because I just see the film for exactly what it is. It's trying really hard to excite its viewer, and obviously, it's just going to fail miserably on me. So I try to enjoy them for aesthetic purposes. And despite preferring men, you can still appreciate feminine beauty in the same way that straight men appreciate the handsome looks of other men. Haini is, for all intents and purposes, rather mesmerising, even for someone like me, as she embodies that tropical paradise that the film is set in. At least D'Amato's casting was pretty spot on, considering that the film is marketed towards a male audience. For me, though, Black Orgasm is just too much miss and not enough hit. It's nowhere near as graphic as I expected, it doesn't have that much of an enticing story, other than just a contrived excuse to get to the next sex or the wank scene. So for Joe D'Amato fans or sexploitation fans, this might be right up your street, but for me, I probably won't be watching this again anytime soon. The role of Helen was played by Nieves Navarro, who's more commonly known by her stage name Susan Scott. We've seen her before in Emmanuel and the Last Cannibals, but she'd been in a wealth of Italian films like Death Walks on High Heels, All the Colours of the Dark, and Death Walks at Midnight. Paul was played by American hunk Richard Harrison, who'd featured in a large number of beefcake male model magazines for his muscular physique. His blonde and meaty looks eventually landed him several sword and sandal roles in the 60s, after which his career spiralled into other Italian genres, such as the spaghetti western, spy movies, Nazi exploitation, and even Poliziotteschi films. Stuff like Achtung, the Desert Tigers, or the Section 3 nasty Mad Dog Killer. He eventually ended up as the unwilling character Ninja Master Gordon in a couple of Hong Kong ninja flicks by Godfrey Ho, but in true exploitation style, footage of these few films of Harrison was interspersed into almost 20-odd ninja films overall, which he was reportedly not happy with, causing him to return to America. He reduced his roles in the early 80s and has since kind of retired completely, only occasionally contributing to scripts or doing some producing. Lucia Ramirez played the sultry Hyene, and she'd be used by D'Amato in most of his tropical-based exploitation fare, like Erotic Nights of the Living Dead, Hard Sensation, Porno Holocaust, and 1982's Cannibal Love. She is pretty much consigned to just these films, though, as she made no other appearances. And another rather well-utilised actor in the film is that of Mark Shannon, who plays the man that Hyene gives a blowjob to in her fantasy sequence. Shannon had also appeared in most of D'Amato's filmography, unlike his co-star Ramirez, in both softcore and hardcore capacities. It's really hard for us to imagine today, as it never really caught on, but Joe D'Amato did quite a few of these hardcore pornographic combinations with other genres. It's not hard to see why D'Amato was targeted during the Nasty Scare, really, as those films would have certainly been declared obscene simply by the combination of real sex plus graphic violence. And actually, they'd probably have trouble even being released today, quite frankly. There's no other cast members of note, however, mostly because the film doesn't really credit anyone else, and it is impossible to find out who everyone is. We've encountered the writer and director Joe D'Amato many times before, of course, not the least of which was our first Cannibal episode where we covered his two films, Emmanuel and the Last Cannibals, and Papaya, Love Goddess of the Cannibals. He also got named during the Nasty Scare as he directed two of the successfully prosecuted titles, Absurd and Anthropophagus. The appropriately porno-sounding music was from Stelvio Cipriani, who again we've mentioned before. Most people would know him for his jaunty lounge music that he composed for Mario Bava's video Nasty, A Bay of Blood. Cinematographer Alberto Spagnoli had been mentioned before too on quite a lot of things like Killer Fish and Cut and Run. Editing was done by Haidee Morris in her only film credit, but I have to say that some of the sequences in this film are very hard to understand because of the editing. I'm going to put this down, though, to the fact that both softcore and hardcore scenes are spliced in at random, so the final edit is probably just a little bit messy. Makeup was done by Pietro Tenoglio, who'd worked on various films like Ghost House, Stage Fright, and Castle Freak. But that's pretty much it for the crew as well. The film was clearly such a small production, and an obscure one even today, that hardly anyone will have heard of. And this is where talking about the release dates and stuff gets rather difficult, as it appears Black Orgasm never got a theatrical release anywhere. Due to the hardcore inserts, I'm not particularly surprised, but there does seem to be no information at all on any sort of release, with the exception of just the year 1980. I can only find small fleeting references to several European VHS releases, but they're incredibly rare even by today's standards, and not much information can be gleaned on them. If the film had been released on pre-cert VHS in Britain, it would have definitely been seized without doubt, simply for the fact that hardcore pornography was illegal during the 80s. Even softcore sex films were being censored and prosecuted outside of the whole Nasties debacle. The fact that this film contains at least two graphic shots of dicks and a whole lot of female masturbating, this too would have been too much for the BBFC to accept, especially with that rather troublesome non-consensual to suddenly consensual sex scene. As luck would have it, though, the film had no chance of getting over here at all, as even in Italy the VHS was a rarity, and the film is so obscure I couldn't even find an English language version to watch, nor even a complete VHS artwork. This is one of those odd cases where a film is just so rare that it's nigh impossible for even VHS collectors back in the day to obtain a copy. Even modern DVD copies have only surfaced so far in Italy and Germany, in Italian language only, with English subtitles. And they retail at around £90 a pop, due to them being out of print and sought after by only the most dedicated of Joe D'Amato fans. If any of my listeners have this film in their collection, I'd just love to hear from you about where you got it, just to simply let me know that the film isn't completely lost forever. It sure would impress me, as it was single-handedly the most troublesome of films that I've had to locate ever. I was half tempted to change the film for this episode until I finally got a copy. So to all you collectors out there, I commend you for the painstaking effort that you have to go through to get some of your fill. So, that was Black Orgasm, and it's the last of our cannibal love stories this week. It's also the last time we'll encounter cannibals of any sort, so you can safely say goodbye to any and all cannibal movie staples from now on. Next week, however, those of you who love retail therapy and shopaholic behaviour will appreciate next week's double bargain. Next up on the Nasty Pasty are two shopping slashers, where slicing, dicing and murder are all going cheap, exclusively available within the tranquil outlets of commerce amongst the weekly groceries and the sundries. They are 1986's Chopping Mall and 1989's Intruder, both very fun and very memorable for very different reasons. Until that time, save your pennies, and I'll see you all next week. Farewell for now!